First John, chapter 4, verse 20, to chapter 5, verse 21, the fifth talk in a series on the Apostle John's three letters, was presented by Colin Stetter on November 26, 2017, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A translation of 1 John by Colin Stetter accompanies this talk.
Well, it's good to see you guys all again. Thanks for being here. So we're going to continue in 1 John. Hopefully we're going to finish it up today. So I'll try to make up for in ground covered what would be there in content. All right, so before moving on, I want to look real quick again at the section where John talks about loving other people. I think it's critical when we are looking at that we need to really look clearly at what that kind of love looks like. What is he calling us to? And I think in order to get a fuller picture of that, we need to take into account that section in 2 John where he advises the congregation on how they ought to deal with the false teachers. Because one could think from John's words in the first letter that what we are to do is to love others indiscriminately, and that what that love looks like is always providing for their physical needs. But let's look at what he writes in 2 John real quick. So in verse 9, he says, "Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching, he has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting. For the one who greets him, who gives him a greeting, participates in his evil deeds." So we have to take that into account. Now, if we look back at the example of Jesus that was given in 1 John, we notice that there the provision is for our spiritual needs. And some could accuse John, I think, from that 2 John passage of advising them of doing something unloving, right? Just as some would see Jesus cleansing the temple as being unloving. I mean, it's a pretty harsh thing he's telling them to do. Shut the door in their face. Don't have anything to do with them. And presumably, these false teachers would have come to that congregation in the same need of hospitality and provision as the apostles and their representatives. So John, I think, clearly sees that the congregation has a responsibility first to love them by responding appropriately to their claims rather than their physical needs. So I think here what we're seeing is John advising his audience to love the false teachers by providing for them precisely what they need and that they're able to provide, that is, resistance to their evil. They're to love the false teachers by giving them the truth. And the truth is that their lies have no part with the truth, and that for as long as they, the false teachers, continue in their rebellion against the truth, they don't share fellowship. So it's actually a loving thing that they're doing by through their actions, confronting these false teachers with the choice that they're making and, you know, what dire consequences there are for that choice and what an evil it is that they're participating in. Okay. All right, so let's look at 20 now. So this is 4:20 through 5:3a, the first half of verse 3 of chapter 5. So now I think he's moving on to a fifth criteria. And whereas before, usually we see the criteria and then the corollary given, here he seems to be starting with the corollary. So he's starting with the "and love those who do X." So further, If anyone would claim to love God while hating his brother, then he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother, who stands before him, cannot love God who is hidden from him. This teaching we have from him, that the one who loves God should love his brother. Anyone who believes that Jesus is the Messiah has been born of God. And anyone who loves the Father will love his child. In this way, we know that we love God, when we hold fast to his teaching and love those born of him. For this is the love of God, that we uphold his instructions. So here John's narrowing the scope of those loved from human beings in general to the brother, the fellow believer in the messiahship of Jesus. And I think here John is really arguing that very simply, if one shows that they don't love the child of God who stands right there in front of him, the one visibly manifesting the character of the Father, then they can't love the Father himself, who they don't see, but who is the source of those spiritual traits that are manifesting in the life of the individual. Right? It just doesn't make any sense. So John's reminding them that this teaching, then, they have from Jesus, that the one who loves God ought to naturally love others who share that love, their brother. And who is the brother? The brother is the one who, like them, has been born of God, the one who has put their faith in the messiahship of Jesus. This is the basis for the criteria that the child of God can apply. The one who loves the Father will love the child of the Father. So by loving their brother, they uphold his instructions and thereby demonstrate their love for God. Okay, let's look at the next one, 21. So this is the second half of verse 3 of chapter 5 through verse 12. Belief in the facts about Jesus' life, agreement with the testimony of the Father concerning the Son. Furthermore, what he taught is no burden. For everyone who has been born of God has overcome the world. And this is the substance of our victory over the world, that we have come to believe the truth. For who is it in whom victory over the world is displayed, but in the one who believes that Jesus is the Messiah? This Jesus is the one who came through water and blood, not by water alone, but by the blood and by the Spirit. And it's the Spirit who bears witness, because the Spirit is the source of the truth. There are three instances in which the Spirit has borne witness: his transfiguration, his baptism, and his crucifixion. And in all three cases, the message was the same. So if we take the testimony of men, the testimony of God is greater. And this is the testimony of God, that he has given his affirmation on behalf of his Son. The one who believes in the truth about the Son holds to the Father's testimony about him. The one who does not believe God has effectively made him, God, out to be a liar, because he has not believed in his testimony concerning his Son. And this is the testimony which God has given. God has given life in the final age to us, and this life is through his Son. Whoever has the Son has life. Whoever rejects the Son rejects life. Okay, let's look first at the statement that he makes at the beginning. In what sense is what he taught not a burden? This is a tricky one for me, and I'm puzzled over it for a while. Because the first thing that jumped to mind was, well, it must not be a burden because he's not placing us under the law, right? Wasn't the law effectively a burden, this performative religion by which they sought to make themselves pleasing and acceptable to God? But that's not what he goes on to talk about in this section. He goes on to talk about it not being a burden because they have victory over the world. So I was trying to make sense, what is the connection he's seeing here? Maybe John has in mind that the belief that the child of God comes to, and in doing so is overcoming the spirit of disbelief in the world, is an act of faith authored by God himself. And so it's not a burden in that it is not placed on our shoulders, but owes its genesis and maintenance to the work of the Spirit of Truth. I mean, I think that's true, but I don't think it really gets to the heart of what he has in mind here. It occurred to me, maybe he's concerned with his audience understanding the scope and extent of what Jesus taught us the Father requires of the individual in order to overcome the world. It's not that to overcome the world, one must uphold the law, and I wonder if that's what these false teachers might have in mind, that they have this sort of conception of the struggle that they are engaged in against the world is a struggle against the Gentile world. So if that's what they have in mind, then one would have to uphold the law, which would place the burden on the individual, as if that true division is between Jew and Gentile. But I wonder if what John is arguing for here is that, well, there is a struggle, and it is a struggle against the world, but you've really misunderstood what the world is, what's really at the heart of this struggle that we engage in. Maybe the cosmos, that world, that set of things that one has to strive against, is not the world of the Gentiles, but the world of unbelief, the cosmos of unbelief, the cosmos of Antichrist, of values that are utterly opposed to God and his purposes. He's talked about the lusts of the flesh and the lusts of the eyes and the boastful pride of life before. And I wonder if this is what he has in mind here, that this is the real battle that the child of God faces, whether or not they will humble themselves and put their belief in how the Father has chosen to give life. I mean, you notice how focused John is on making it clear that this is what the Father wants of us. That is, to believe in the truth about Jesus, that he is the promised Messiah, and to believe in the facts about his life, to believe that in all points on which the Father testified on behalf of the Son, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased, that we say, yes, I agree, he truly is the Son, and to love others who do likewise, and that this, then, is the essential victory over the world that sets the child of God apart. So I wonder if that's really what's behind this discussion here. I mean, in so many places we've seen that the false teachers, part of what's so insidious about their lie is that it's close enough to the truth to be deceiving, right? John says, this is what righteousness looks like. Well, presumably the false teachers, they would be claiming to be pursuing righteousness, but it's their definition of what righteousness looks like and what's involved in actually being righteous that's off the mark. They would claim to have fellowship with Jesus, but what does that fellowship look like? And how far does that extend? It's just to the left. And in being so, it's a lie and it's a diabolical one because it's hard to recognize. And I wonder if here we have something similar. Sure, you know, we are in a struggle against the world, but what they're conceiving of as the world that they really have to do battle with is not the one that God is interested in us doing battle with. It's not that by upholding the law and continuing to be a good Jew, you have distanced yourself from the world, the Gentile world, and all that it represents, you know, because that's really what God is interested in, you not being one of them. Rather, the world is this system of values that seeks to undermine our belief, our acceptance of the truth, our willingness to humble ourselves before the Father and say yes to what he says yes to. Okay. So he goes on to talk about not only the water, but the blood and the Spirit witnessing to Jesus. So what is he talking about there? Well, I went back and I looked through the Gospels for those times where God the Father made a proclamation about the Son, about who the Son was. And this is what I found. So I think this is the witness of the water that John is referencing here. So if we look in Matthew 3:13, Jesus arrived from Galilee at the Jordan, coming to John to be baptized by him. But John tried to prevent him, saying, "I have need to be baptized by you, and yet you come to me." But Jesus, answering him, said to him, "Permit it at this time, for in this way it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness." And then he permitted him. And after being baptized, Jesus went up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove, coming upon him. And behold, a voice out of the heavens saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." What's critical there, it seems, is that when Jesus was baptized, that those who were present heard this voice coming out of heaven testifying that this one Jesus, was in fact the Son that they were awaiting and in whom God the Father is well pleased. So I think that's the first instance that John's pointing to that's critical that we do business with and come to the point of saying, "I will accept the Father's testimony about the Son." Okay, the second is the witness of the Spirit. And I think what dovetails nicely with that is if we go to Matthew 17, starting at verse 1, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. And Peter answered and said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three tabernacles here, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." And while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were much afraid. And Jesus came to them and touched them and said, "Arise, do not be afraid." And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. So the second instance there, where the Father testifies on behalf of the identity of the Son. So what about the third, the witness of the blood? This one was a little tougher because I was looking at the Gospels and I couldn't find an account where there's a similar statement from the Father, you know, verbatim, saying, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." But I wonder if what John doesn't have in mind are the events that accompanied the crucifixion that he must see, in essence, testifying to the same reality. So if we look at the end of Matthew 27, starting in verse 45, "Now from the sixth hour, darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' that is, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?' And some of those who were standing there, when they heard it, began saying, 'This man is calling for Elijah.' And immediately one of them ran and, taking a sponge, filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the rest of them said, 'Let us see whether Elijah will come and save him.' And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split and the tombs were opened, and many bodies of saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now the centurion and those who were with him keeping guard over Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, became very frightened and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." So perhaps that's what John has in mind as the witness of the blood, is these events, these supernaturally authored events that occurred surrounding his crucifixion, that he's taking as God's testimony to the fact that this was his Son who was being crucified. So if one of you has a line on a better place for me to look for that witness of the blood, I would be in the market for that. I'd love to know if you guys have something. Okay. Do you have any questions at this point? Okay. So again, I think it's really striking. If we look back on the section we've been talking about, how forefront it is in John's mind that his readers understand that it is critical that they accept the testimony that the Father gave about the Son. I mean, Jesus himself, you know, said that if you want life, you have to come through me, right? The Father's given me the keys to the kingdom, but I only do what I see the Father doing. I will only do what the Father tells me. So, in essence, we have from the Son this picture that he is the only source of life, and yet that ultimately all that he does is the will of the Father. And so John is incredibly concerned that they understand that their faith in Jesus and their acceptance of his teaching and of the facts of his life ultimately rests on their desire to submit themselves to the will of the Father. It's critical to him. And I think it's critical in this context because, you know, clearly his audience wants to know that they are doing the will of the Father. They want to know that they have fellowship with the Father. And these false teachers are claiming that they have fellowship with the Father and that they have a line on what the Father wants from them. So all the more reason that John would really be stressing here, no, this is all about what the Father wants you to do. This is all about what the Father has testified to and put his stamp of approval on. So, pretty striking. Okay, so many papers. All right, let's look at the next section. 22, this is 5, 13 through 17. So John has finished with the bulk of his argument, and we're moving into his sort of final remarks, his concluding remarks. And here he's going to reassure his audience that life awaits those who have put their belief in Jesus. So he says, "I've written these things to you in order to assure you that by your belief in the name of the Son of God, you already are destined for life in the final age. Before the Father, we have this confidence that he will hear us in anything that we ask of him that accords with his will. So, if we have this confidence that he hears us in whatever we ask, then we know that we are in possession of that which we have asked of him. If any of you should see your brother committing a sin that is not tantamount to the rejection of the life-giving God, ask on his behalf. And if it's in keeping with his will, the Father will give life to such a one. Of course, there are those whose evil will culminate in destruction. And in this case, it's fruitless to ask for life on their behalf. All unrighteousness is evil, but not all evil will culminate in destruction." So here, I mean, really, he's circling back to the statements that he made earlier about the confidence that he has in this congregation, that they already are in possession of everything that they need to attain to life. He wants them to be confident, and he wants them to have a sense of peace that if they have believed the truth that was communicated to them through the apostles or their emissaries, then the Spirit of truth is at work in their lives. All they need to do is to hold fast to that teaching. And they can be confident that life is theirs. I mean, there really isn't much that God has guaranteed us in life. But this is one thing, that if we want life, if we believe in the gospel and we seek him first, life is ours. That's a wonderful, empowering, life-changing promise that we have from him. So, and the way that I tried to translate this, I hope, makes this very clear, that when John goes on to talk about the Father hearing them in whatever they ask of him, that really, again, this question that they have on their minds, the question that they are asking of the Father is, do we have life? Will you give us life? Is life ours? So, from what John knows about this congregation, yeah, life is yours. Keep asking. Keep seeking. God isn't going to shut the door in your face. And, it seems, he wants them to have the sort of attitude where they don't give up on seeking life for one another. Presumably, you know, there are both those false teachers in their midst who have rocked things in that congregation, and then there are also probably people in that congregation who have found the message of the false teachers to be somewhat interesting, compelling, and who are wavering. They're on the fringes here. And John's saying, don't give up on these people. Don't look at them and say, you know, you're no longer my brother. I'm no longer going to seek life for you. I'm no longer going to invest myself in persuading you of the truth, in praying that God opens your eyes and your heart. You're dead to me, essentially. Well, that's not the attitude that John has. That's not the attitude that compelled him to write this letter. And that's not the attitude he wants them to have. He wants them to continue to seek life for one another, to continue to love one another. And, you know, if they are people whose life looks like they are pursuing evil, either through their choices, perhaps they are like this fellow Demetrius, who is putting others out of the church, or, you know, maybe they are those who are, you know, wavering with what to believe. Are they going to bail on the gospel that the apostles gave them? Are they going to accept what the false teachers have been teaching them? That they should keep hope alive in their hearts and see that loving their brother, loving these people in their midst, looks like continuing to reflect the truth to them and continuing to ask for life from the Father on their behalf. Now, if in loving and seeking good for them and reflecting the truth to them, they come to this point where they recognize, you know, this person has really decided that they don't want life and they don't want the truth, then, you know, John's saying, well, then that must be where they're at, and don't ask for life on their behalf, because clearly the Father doesn't intend to give life to them based on their choices, their pattern of behavior, what you're seeing in their life. But it seems like that's a caveat that is an exception, and John wants them to really remember that even though, and this is how he finishes, all unrighteousness is evil, not all evil will culminate in destruction. Don't assume just by the fact that they are pursuing unrighteousness or that it looks like unrighteousness is taking root in their life that destruction awaits them. Don't just make that assumption. That's a judgment that's in God's hands, and often that judgment is hidden from us. Okay, so let's look at the conclusion here real quick. So these things we know. No one who is a child of God will persist in evil. The one who was born of God keeps him, so that the evil one has no power over him. We are of God, and yet the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. The true Son of God has come and has given us understanding in order that we might know what is true. We are in the truth in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true Son and life aeonian. Dear ones, remember, guard yourselves against idols. So I think here John is stepping back and he's reflecting on himself and the position that he's in and what he knows to be true. So these things we know. No one who is a child of God will persist in evil. The one who is born of God keeps him, so that the evil one has no power over him. So I wonder if this is a warning to them, perhaps, that if they are sincerely seeking God, that they will not persist in evil, that they will do everything in their power to reject the evil in their presence, to reject the false teachers and their teaching. But it's also a reminder to them that this is a reality about the child of God that they need to remember, that the one who is born of God, Jesus keeps that one, so the evil one has no power over him. So they should remember that being children of God, they have all the reason in the world to have confidence that the Father is on their side and will continue to lead them into the kingdom. And that the spirit of Antichrist that these false teachers are teaching out of has no power, it has no authority over them. God keeps them, and he will continue to instruct them. They need to stick to the faith and continue to trust God with that process. We, the apostles, are of God, and yet the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. So again, he's making that division crystal clear to them, right? The apostles and the message that they have, they are from God, but the world lies in the power of the evil one. These false teachers, their message, what they're offering, it's from the world, and ultimately, it's a product of evil. And what is it that the apostles have to testify to? That the true Son of God has come and has given us understanding in order that we might know what is true. So listen to me. Listen to my message. We are in the truth in his Son, Jesus Christ. He is the true Son, and he is the source of life eternal. There is no other. Dear ones, remember to guard yourself against idols. A fascinating, fascinating final line. What does he have in mind here? Well, I was thinking about this, and I think that, I mean, it's clear idols can exist in different senses, right? And I think that we've seen at least four different ways in which idols can manifest themselves, or in which you can have an idol. At least four that I can think of. I don't think this is exhaustive, but these are the four that came to mind. So the first one is a replacement of the God that is explicitly a replacement for the God who is really there with a God that is explicitly other, right? So if you think of turning to a Baal or an Asherah instead of Yahweh, I think that's the first sense in which the Bible talks about idols, and that's pretty obvious. I mean, that's probably the most often encountered, at least in Israel's history. And that's usually what comes to mind, because it seems like that's what the nation is constantly rubbing up against, is the fact that because they live shoulder to shoulder with all these pagan peoples, and because they're human beings who crave security and who crave some kind of comfort that they're going to be okay and they're going to be protected, and that the forces that are around them aren't going to be powerful enough to overwhelm them. They turn to these idols. You know, might as well cover our bases and get these other gods on our side as well. So that's I think, the first sense. Replacing Yahweh with some other explicit and identifiable God. Okay, the second one, I think, is replacing God with some kind of temporal or worldly value that we seek after that gives our lives shape, content, and meaning. I think that what John's identifying as things like the lusts of the flesh and the lusts of the eyes and the pride of life are idols in that sense. Wealth, health, things that we seek after that aren't explicit gods that we are giving our allegiance to and believing are actually forces that are out there in reality that are shaping things, but that certainly shape our lives and shape our choices and our values by informing what we seek after and what we pour our energy and our allegiance into. That's much more common, I think, in our culture. And that's what we struggle against on a daily basis. The world and its values and giving it our allegiance and our love. So those two options, it seems, explicitly replace God with the worship of another. Now the next two, I think, are a little more subtle. And while they don't replace God per se, they do refuse to accept God on his terms and instead reinterpret either God's commands or God's person in such a way as to serve ourselves and our own needs. So if you were here for David's teaching on the golden calf, I thought that was a really compelling picture for how an idol in this third sense can work. That here we see a way in which these people have replaced the mysterious and frightening otherness of God with a mechanism that they understood and that they were comfortable with, through which they believed they could interact with the divine in order to have their needs met. So if you remember, the argument was that this golden calf that the Israelites created when they were hanging out on the slopes of Sinai waiting for Moses to come down, and probably wondering what on earth is taking this guy so long. He's been up there 40 days. And what is going on with this terrifying God who's led us out of Egypt, who is up there in this cloud of lightning and thunder and earthquakes? And to them, irrationality. I mean, I think that they were utterly unprepared to deal with the awesomeness and otherness of God at that point. So they went back to these ancient Near East systems of interacting with the divine that they thought, okay, well, at least if we do this, we can get God to come and meet with us and give us what we want. An answer, direction, favor, blessing, I don't know. But in creating the calf, they were creating a space and a locus where they believed the divine would come down, rest, meet them, and that they could then appease and, you know, get some movement happening, get some change happening to this stressful, anxiety-filled, fearful space of waiting that they were in. Now, the great evil of that was that instead of waiting on God to move in his own time and in his own way, they were forcing the issue. It's the same thing, you know, when Jesus was in the wilderness and the devil was tempting him, saying, "You're hungry, why don't you make the stone into bread?" And he said, No, I don't want to take my own survival and the culmination of this test that God has put me in the midst of into my own hands and decide that now is when I eat, now is when this testing is done, now is when I care for myself. No, man doesn't live on bread alone. If God has decided to take me into the wilderness to finish me, so be it. God be praised. It's his will that I seek, not mine. So I think that's the same evil that was in the hearts of the Israelites in that instance. They weren't willing to submit themselves to how God was doing business with them in that moment. They were deciding, no, we don't really like the way that you're doing business with us. We're going to provide a different means and a different mechanism. And there is an idolatry there, because it is deciding to restructure the terms in which you are interacting with God so that your needs and your comfort are being met. We're rewriting the covenant in a way. The last that I can think of that comes to mind is reimagining God or Jesus, usually through distorting elements of their character or teaching such that they become more palatable to us. So, you know, you think about so many of the visions of who God is and what he wants, who Jesus is and what he's all about that we confront on a day-to-day basis. How many of those are merely products of our own picking and choosing attributes and teachings of God or Jesus and saying, I like this, I don't like that, this is the Jesus I'm going to do business with, not that Jesus. I like the Jesus who, you know, fed the 5,000. I don't like the Jesus who came to bring the sword. I don't like the Jesus who causes me to confront myself and look inward and do business with my own evil. I like the Jesus that says what life and salvation is about is going out there and seeking, you know, social justice for everybody. And I think we can think of example after example of that sort of thing, right? That's making an idol. That's creating an idol. It's taking traits that we like and fashioning a new God for ourselves that we want to do business with, rather than the God who is there. When I was going through Jeremiah with David, we came across this wonderful section where Jeremiah talks about idols and what is true about idols, and I wanted to read that to you guys, so bear with me, because I think this is worth hearing. So Jeremiah in chapter 10 says, "Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the nations. Do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them. For the customs of the peoples are delusion, because it is wood cut from the forest, the work of the hands of a craftsman with a cutting tool. They decorate it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, so that it will not totter. Like a scarecrow in a cucumber field are they, and they cannot speak. They must be carried, because they cannot walk. Do not fear them, for they can do no harm, nor can they do any good. There is none like thee, O Lord. Thou art great, and great is thy name and might. Who would not fear thee, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is thy due. For among all the wise men of the nations, in all their kingdoms, there is none like thee. But they are altogether stupid and foolish in their discipline of delusion. Their idol is wood, beaten silver, brought from Tarshish, gold from Uphaz, the work of a craftsman, the hands of a goldsmith. Violet and purple are their clothing. They are all the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God, the everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure his indignation. Thus you shall say to them, the gods that did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens. It is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding stretched out the heavens. And when he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth. He makes lightning for rain. He brings out the wind from his storehouses. Every man is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols, for his molten images are deceitful, and there is no breath in them. They are worthless, a work of mockery. In the time of their punishment, they will perish. The portion of Jacob, he is not like these. For the maker of all is he, and Israel is the tribe of his inheritance. The Lord of hosts is his name. And what a wonderful poetic picture of the utter bankruptcy of the idols that so many strive after, that these are dead constructs of human hands and human minds that are utterly incapable of good or evil. They have no place in either the management of reality or in the redemption of your life. They're dead. And I think the same attitude that we see Jeremiah here reflecting about the idols that he saw around him in the Israel of his time, in the nations that surrounded Israel of his time, it's the same attitude that God has about the idols that so many set up in his name. These idols that are constructs of human hands and human imagination that take the place of not only the real God, but also the real Jesus. Okay, any questions about that? There's a lot there.
Maybe I missed it, so forgive me. But mm-hmm. So you went through your four options or ideas for what mm-hmm. idols are. So did you circle back around and say what you think he's, which one of those you think he's addressing mm-hmm. primarily, the last one? Or?
I think in a way there's a couple of those options that these false teachers are guilty of, and that his audience is in danger of emulating. I don't think that it's the first. I mean, they're not replacing worship of Yahweh with worship of an explicitly other God. And I don't think that, I think in a sense, it's all the other three, that there's a sense in which they're guilty of all the other ways in which idolatry can manifest. Most clearly, it's the last one, that they are in refusing to accept the totality of what God has affirmed about his son, and instead picking and choosing what they will accept about Jesus. You know, I think clearly in that sense they've created an idol out of Jesus, an idol to substitute for the actual historical Jesus. We like this Jesus who was baptized and, you know, seemed to be hip on repentance and upholding the law. We like that Jesus, and we're going to go with him as far as what he taught up to that point, but we're not going to follow him beyond that. But I think in a way, they're also doing a replacement for what God wants of us with other values that give their lives scope and meaning. And I think that goes back to the discussion of the desire for respectability, valuing that worldly value, loving that to the extent that's really what's informing their choices and their attitudes and their actions, not a love for God. So I think that they're guilty of that as well. And then I think in a way, returning to the law and saying, if I'm right about what they're teaching, that if they are teaching a return to the Mosaic Covenant as the mechanism by which we can be approved of by God, then they're also guilty of the same thing that Israel was guilty of when they made the calf, you know, saying that, well, if you want to do business with us through faith and through belief in your testimony about the Son, we're going to go the other way, and we're going to go back to the law as a means of gaining favor that we understand and are comfortable with, and that's where we're going to stay. So I think there's a way in which all three of those are playing a role in what's going on there.
I don't remember if you explicitly mentioned this, but I'm looking at the Greek text, not your translation, but mm-hmm. at the end of 20, he says, this one, by which he means Jesus, mm-hmm. this one, Jesus, is the true God mm-hmm. and eternal life, and then immediately says, beloved children, guard yourselves from idols.
Right.
So I think the contrast between Jesus being the true God
right.
and beware of idols reinforces your point that mm-hmm. the emphasis is on you have a distorted view of Jesus.
Right. Yeah, no, thank you for the reminder. I mean, that's a great reminder that why else would he take the time there to make it so explicit that this one that I've been talking about, he is the true Son. And it does make sense that if in contrasting that with what immediately follows, which is this juncture to guard themselves against idols, that must be what he has in mind, that it behooves you to do business with the real Jesus, with everything that was true about him and everything that he taught. Because if you don't, then you are fabricating something.
And then if I could back up, mm-hmm. maybe just a little soliloquy here, and my question is, how would you respond to this? I mean, are you, how much of this did you have in mind, or how much of this do you agree with or disagree with? When you go back to, I think it's 5:6, this one is the one coming in or through the water and the blood, Jesus the Christ. Not in the water only, but also in the water and the blood, and in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't remember you commenting on that, but it strikes me that there's more to the water and the blood than just simply the testimony, although mm-hmm. there is that, certainly. And he makes a big deal out of the fact that God testified from heaven, this is my beloved Son,
mm-hmm.
one, and then something else after that. But in each case, he says, this is my Son. He did it at the baptism. He did it at the transfiguration. He did it in connection with his death. And by the way, there is a passage in John, not right at the crucifixion, mm-hmm. but the last week, he announces his crucifixion, mm-hmm. and a voice comes out of heaven saying, this is my Son, listen to him, I think.
Cool, thank you.
And that is in connection with his announcement of his death. So that may also be what John has in mind. But he makes a big deal out of not the water only, but also the water and the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but think it must be in contrast to these false teachers. They're fine with the water,
mm-hmm.
but not the water and the blood.
Mm-hmm.
They're fine with the baptism of John, but not the baptism of John and the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave off the crucifixion part.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that's the idol, mm-hmm. really, in fact.
Yeah.
It's the Jesus who said, I agree with John the Baptist, let's go back and return to, I think you said that earlier in your,
right.
a few weeks ago, let's go back to the law, let's repent, let's go back to the law, let's keep the law. That's what Jesus was all about.
Mm-hmm.
And John is saying, yeah, he was about that.
Mm-hmm.
But he also came to die in order that we might live
right.
on the cross. And you guys aren't buying that.
Right.
So you have a false Jesus here that you're peddling.
Yeah, I think I find that compelling. When I was, it's funny, another example of the unhelpfulness of commentary apparatus. The the note for that when I was studying this takes you to that section in the Gospels where he's pierced with the spear and water and blood flow out. It's like, well, okay. doesn't seem to have any bearing on what's going on here. So I don't know why they send you there, other than it's just the, you know, the geographic nearness of these two words. But yeah, I mean, I think clearly, you know, why would he go on to make such a big deal about the testimony of the Father at the water, the Spirit, and the blood? And I think that it is, you know, those points at which God affirmed the truth of Jesus' messiahship at the baptism, the transfiguration, and at his crucifixion, and that the role that all those three played in the narrative God had for this one, Jesus, are critical to understanding who he was and how he functions as well. You know, that the crucifixion as the means by which Jesus offered himself up as that propitiatory offering, you know, provided that foundation, the basis for which, you know, God is going to grant mercy, is critical to understanding who he was and why God sent him in the first place. So you tear the content out of Jesus and his narrative if you leave that out. What's the point? You're left in the same place of, you know, David going, how is this going to work? How are you going to provide mercy for me? And why would you prefer that if you have from the Father himself this promise that I have given you life and all you need to do is seek it and it's yours? Like, why would you choose to go back to that place where you prefer to have that question unanswered? It's crazy.
Thanks, Colin. Mm-hmm. I have a question that strikes me as difficult. Mm-hmm. You may have some really good ideas, and if you do, that's great. If you don't, feel free to punt. In verse 16, especially the way that you... I don't have your notes here, sorry. Mm-hmm. So in the Bible, in the verse 16, it's the way you translated it made it sound like John thinks we can tell which is which is the person who may be committing sin, but it's not unto death, and mm-hmm. versus the person who is committing sin that is unto death. And to use this phrase in the original sense, it sort of begs the question. It's like it assumes that you know what you don't really know if you're going to make that distinction, and mm-hmm. therefore, if that distinction and his advice about it, mm-hmm. who to pray for and who not to pray for, is of any practical value. Mm-hmm.
So the question is there any way to know really if the unrighteousness that is present in someone's life is indicative of the sort of evil that is going to lead to destruction?
Yes, exactly. And this comes home to Debbie and me because, by all appearances, neither of our sons mm-hmm. are leading lives that would give us any expectation that they have faith or that they ever will have faith. Mm-hmm. And so, does this mean we should not be praying for them? Mm-hmm. I doubt if you're going to
talk... Well, I'm not going to answer that one for you.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt if you're going to talk me into that one. But then, yeah. What does John have in mind? I told you it was tough.
Yeah, no, that's... that is not a question I'm going to answer for you with respect to your own boys, because you know them far better than I do. But it is the case that over and over we are given parables and pictures of one who is being led into life and one who has effectively rejected the truth to their own destruction, right? Whether it's... I think about the person who blasphemes the Spirit. I mean, maybe that's the only really explicit evidence we have is if time and again they are utterly hostile to the truth of the gospel, the actual gospel, the authentic gospel. Not like a temporary off-the-cuff Peter sort of denial, but that manifest time and again rejection, the opposite of the sort of evidence that we can see unfolding in our lives as through circumstances that test our faith and our willingness to submit ourselves to the Father, we do so. You know, maybe it's the converse of that, that it's the sort of thing that you really need time and evidence in order to make an educated guess on. I mean, he does seem to be willing to call these false teachers false teachers. And he does seem to be willing to say of them, they are of the world, they are speaking out of Antichrist, they are children of the devil. So he, at least in their case, seems to be willing to make a pretty hard line judgment about them. So at least in their case, it seems that the evidence is their manifest rejection of the gospel, their rejection of the messiahship of Jesus. But again, I mean, that's a really tough call. Yeah, Jack.
It seems like there's another way to take what John is saying that, mm-hmm. that makes more sense to me than reading it. If they're committing this kind of sin, pray for them. If they're committing this other kind of sin, don't pray for them. I don't think that's what John is saying. Mm-hmm. That doesn't, I mean, as you point out, how would you ever obey that? Mm-hmm. I mean, in the circumstances of our life, we're going to be praying. Mm-hmm. But I think what makes more sense is, let me give you a scenario. Somebody's committing a sin, and this sin is not a sin leading to death, and you pray for them. Under that scenario, I promise you that God will grant life to such a one. That is, it's the promise attached to your request is a part of what he's arguing. Okay, now another scenario. You see a brother committing sin, and he's committing a sin that is leading to death, and you ask for him, you pray for him. I can't make any guarantees about that one. Mm-hmm. God may not give you what you're asking, but I don't think he's saying don't ask. Mm-hmm. He's just saying, I can't promise you in that scenario, I can't promise you that your request is going to be met with a positive answer. But that leaves open much more realistically that, mm-hmm. of course, we're going to pray. When, you know, for our own children right. in particular, of right. course we're going to pray. But we have to come to terms with the fact that if what is going on in their life is they're committing a sin leading to death, we don't have any guarantees from God mm-hmm. that he's going to answer it the way we want it.
So you're seeing if I understand you right, you're seeing the emphasis on what's behind what he's saying, more on, you know, what God himself has promised, and based on what God himself has promised, what kind of confidence can you have when you pray for others?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Jack kind of, I mean, he was addressing mm-hmm. kind of what I was going to say, but I wonder if even further too in 16, if anyone sees a brother, I mean, that it's important that he's actually, if somebody's actually claiming to be mm-hmm. a fellow believer,
right.
which like Bob's sons are not, mm-hmm. if they're claiming to be a fellow believer, but they're continually basically denying Jesus. I mean, let's say they're following these false teachers. The false teachers are claiming to be brothers, mm-hmm. but they're basically, I would say, would probably come under that committing a sin unto death, and that mm-hmm. they're denying the very basis of their what they're claiming to believe. And right. I'm wondering if the verses after, when he's talking about all unrighteousness is sin, and we know that one who is born of God, that no one born of God sins. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the sense, I think of well, you can tell me what you think, but in the sense of continuing to sin. I mean, we all sin, mm-hmm. but our hearts are not set on sinning. So I'm wondering if the verses 17 and 18 and even 19 following are kind of basically defining what he means by a brother committing, you know, that if you pray for a brother who is not committing a sin unto death, mm-hmm. that he will be given life. Mm-hmm. Because, and then he talks about, I mean, because he goes on to say that that we are kept from the evil one. I don't know if I'm being very clear, but I think the part that says it's a brother is really important mm-hmm. with what Jack says, and then I think the verses following are mm-hmm. helping to define what that verse is talking about.
Yeah, I think that you're definitely right that the fact that he's talking about how they should approach seeking life for their brother is important there. Yeah. And I think you're right that you're right, we all sin, we all do, but and kind of going back to his discussion about the pursuit of righteousness, the practice of the commitment to, that it's really about, okay, what do we do with ourselves when we know we've been in the wrong and when somebody confronts us with the reality of our own sin and evil? Are we going to stay committed to it or are we not? Are we going to repent? I mean, that's really what marks the child of God versus one who isn't. And, you know, like you're saying, you know, it makes all the sense in the world to pray for the one who is actually your brother and to be confident that God is going to give them life, you know, even though they might be screwing up in this one instance, because as a child of God, what they're going to be committed to is not their pursuit of unrighteousness, but their pursuit of righteousness. So,
I guess I'm a little confused about what these false teachers, I mean, I shouldn't be after this whole book, but they're calling themselves believers, mm-hmm. but not teaching that Jesus is the Messiah.
Right.
So what is it they're believing in if they're calling themselves believers? I mean, do they believe Jesus was just a good rabbi?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
But so they're kind of following Jesus, but only his kind of teaching, not the fact that he was a Messiah.
Yeah, it seems that are they claiming that they're believers? I don't know. They seem to be claiming that they have fellowship, with Jesus, that they know what's up with him, and that what they're teaching is what Jesus taught.
Right.
And they're claiming to have fellowship with the Father, but it seems clear that they're rejecting certain absolutely essential realities about Jesus and about what he taught, specifically that he was actually the Messiah,
okay, yeah.
and that his death, his crucifixion, was an essential aspect mm-hmm. of his life and ministry, and that in so doing, what they seem to be advocating for based on what they prefer about what Jesus taught is that they go back to repenting and upholding the law of Moses.
Right.
So I think that's what's going on.
So obeying the law of Moses. So mm-hmm. would there have been actual Jews that still believed that Jesus was a good teacher, but that they would follow the... I mean, I'm just trying mm-hmm. to figure out how these false teachers would identify themselves with believing Christians
mm-hmm.
and yet have a... I mean...
Well, I mean, they don't seem to be identifying with believing Christians
okay.
enough to not say, hey, stop believing
right.
X, Y, and Z. Think about historically how many different people ended up, you know, gathering around Jesus at the height of his ministry. I mean, there are thousands who heard him teach, who were fed by him, who followed him around, who took part in his triumphal entry into the city, et cetera, et cetera. Would it make sense that some of those people would have retained some of what they liked about what this guy was teaching and yet didn't actually believe in what Jesus actually taught?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
How many people that did at one point come to faith in the gospel mm-hmm. then later ditch that faith because what was more important to them was their wealth, their happiness, their security, their respectability in the eyes of their community and other Jews, and backed away from the whole of the claims of Jesus in the gospel, and instead just said, I'm just going to hold on to this bit here. That's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So essentially they were Jews that might have felt favorably toward Jesus without calling him the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
It seems to me that at that time, you took a lot more risk being a Jew claiming to be a Christian than you did being a Gentile claiming to be a Christian.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you're kind of, if you're a Gentile and a believer, that's tough. Because there were Jews, you know, like Paul, who were going to persecute Christians, whether you were a Gentile or a Jew. So maybe no matter what, if you're a believer, you're going to get persecution from both sides. But at the very least, as a Jew, I mean, you're getting persecution from the world and from your own people. So nowhere to hide.
And that's what makes me wonder if his use of the term brother isn't Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
In this letter. I mean, because a Gentile can walk away, but a Jew has to live in his community.
Hmm.
I mean, the business connections, the festivals, the holidays, the hospitality. If he stood for Jesus, he'd lose all that.
I mean, I think that you're absolutely right about the pressures that a Jew faced, but I think you've got a tougher job making the case that his use of brother is just confined to Jews in scope, because he does explicitly connect a brother with one who has put their faith in the name of Jesus. And there he doesn't make a distinction about Jew or Gentile in that case. So you got a tougher job there.
And the other thing, when we look at someone we think is not a believer, I once had an argument with a housemate who, my analogy was, if God makes you a chair, be the best chair you can be, but don't claim to be a lamp, right? And so I said, so if God makes you human, we went back and forth. Finally, he goes, okay, I will admit that God can be the creator, but that doesn't mean he's morally superior to me. And I wonder if the surfer Jesus, like, you know, the dude, everybody be cool and share the meal.
Yeah.
He's attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But if the issue for John is righteousness, if it boils down to God saying do and you saying don't, you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If Jesus lays claim on your life, and you refuse that, ultimately it boils down to the issue of goodness. And it seems to me that would be the rebellion that is attractive to the false teachers, and that is the defining the stigma of the unbelieving brother that you may be wasting your prayers on.
Yeah, I think about, you know, Ivan in the Brothers Karamazov, where he says, you know, sure there's a God and a creator and he's in charge of this whole thing, but I don't like the way he runs his universe. And so I'm returning my ticket. I'd rather live apart from him. Which dovetails nicely into my conclusion. So how do we guard ourselves against idols? I think we have to first determine to seek the Lord and his kingdom, but we have to do this with the attitude of learners. We have to ask God to teach us the truth, and we have to embrace the truth, whatever it may be. If our determination is to place ourselves under the scrutiny and judgment of the truth rather than placing ourselves over the truth in order to audit, scrutinize, and judge it according to our own tastes, then we'll be in a much better position to see ourselves and reality clearly and to be shaped by it to our own benefit. Thank you.